tell you, wearing masks with glasses is tough. Those of you who wear glasses know that you're entitled to just compensation. I'm really not clever. I saw that on Facebook. I'm not trying to be funny on what I'm able to do. Every parent, my own included, mandates that their children tell them where they're going and what they're doing and where they're going to be. It's a slippery thing, you know. I was 17 one night because I remind my son. As a teenager, I often wanted to be at certain places with certain people, and it wasn't always a place where people my mother would have been comfortable with. We learned quickly that lax or trusting supervision meant we could say one thing and eventually wind up elsewhere. Like that time my cousin and I were camping out at Granny Searle's house. We did this every so often throughout the summer. We grew up swimming in the lake. And she lived up on the hill above the beach. And sometimes in the summer we would go camping. We'd fish all night, go to bed late. We generally mind our own business, and rarely did we ever really get into any kind of trouble. But one summer night, we packed our stuff, went down to the lake, and everything was fine until we decided that we would walk around. And all the way around the lake, there was a road, and we just thought we'd walk around and look for girls, which we hoped to find, and then we would see what happened. Meanwhile, Granny Searles, who was ever watchful from her screen porch, noticed after a while that she hadn't seen any activity down at the campsite. So naturally, she called our mothers. Our mothers dispatched my older brother, who went on a search and rescue mission to find the lost boys. We weren't lost, but we had found some girls whom we were attempting to entertain. And my brother drove by in his hot rod, spotted us up on the patio, and delivered the message, "Where have you been? Get home now." And we knew that it would be a long walk back to the house. When we got there, there was not only my mother, but his mother, and the interrogation began. "Where have you been? What are you doing? Why weren't you at the campsite?" And I'm thinking, how did you know? Granny Searles, she's like the Gestapo. She knew everything. She was always watching. My cousin made the critical mistake of telling my mother that she was not his mother. No one had ever said that to my mother. My mother was not used to hearing such language from a 17-year-old boy, and I vividly recall that that night did not end well for either of us. In Jesus' day, there were people who were scandalized by the places that Jesus went. He wasn't looking for trouble, and he wasn't looking for entertainment. He was out to seek and to save that which was lost. And that took him to places that were frequented by the likes of tax collectors and sinners and, scandalously, sometimes even prostitutes. I'm not sure Mary, his mother, always wanted to be his mother. I'm sure it must have been difficult at times. And as our gospel lesson opens today, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling as they routinely did, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Imagine that, sinners. They say that with a sneer and kind of spit the words out between their teeth, murmuring through their beards. This group of sinners is marked out as a class that we should know and recognize. The Pharisees and the Sadducees did not see themselves as part of this group. They viewed them as a catch bag of misfit human beings who wouldn't pursue righteousness the way they did. And the Pharisees used this term, sinners, as a kind of racial slur, even against their own Jewish brothers. Gospel writers, of course, turned it around into a kind of messianic identifier. Jesus went around hanging out with sinners. He was criticized by those who had the right religious credentials, the right zip codes. Their criticisms were vicious, and they had just enough religiosity, of course, to bite. In the minds of many people, yeah, the Pharisees were right. Whenever and whoever the Messiah would be, he certainly wouldn't behave like this. Breaking bread with notorious sinners jeopardized one's ritual purity. The Messiah would certainly be keen to protect that. Ritual purity for everyone in the Jewish community was to be protected at all times because participation faithfully in their religion was predicated upon it. Jesus was an easy target for religious smear. And he really didn't defend himself. He did tell some stories, in fact, three stories, which follow in this text today of Luke chapter 15. You know all three of them. Only two were read today. The third one will wait till Trinity 9, 6 weeks from now. The lectionary breaks them apart. We get two today, one in 6 weeks. The two today are recognizable to you. They are about lost things. There's a lost sheep. There's a lost coin. And then later in 6 weeks, we'll remember that there is a lost boy. The first two stories are easy to understand. They're offered by Jesus to demonstrate that his ministry to sinners is justified. The third story is more pointed because there, not only is the Father's love for the Son demonstrated, but Jesus compares the Pharisees to the older brother in that story. But back to the first two stories. A shepherd has 100 sheep, he loses one. We don't have to overthink this. People who work with animals strive to care for them because they have inherent value. They feed them, they tend to their medical needs, and their pain when they lose one to disease or to predators. 100 sheep minus one doesn't seem to us like a big deal. That's 1%. I mean, you would expect in the course of animal husbandry that you lose a critter now and then. The theme here that is established and runs through St. Luke for two chapters, however, is that the thing which could be discarded, the thing which could be ignored, the thing that could be devalued or dismissed as being cheap or just acceptable losses, is not. It is worthy of the object of enormous energy on the part of the shepherd. And by the way, you know who the lost sheep was? Who could have been easily forgotten, easily discarded, and easily devalued as of no value? Well, that would be you. Could have been overlooked. Would it really have mattered in light of eternity? Lose one here or there? There isn't a person out there whose value is so low that Jesus would discard him. And if God places such value on individual people, how much value should we place on them? School yourself in the discipline of seeing people as God would see them. Spend your day remembering to offer everyone you meet respect, dignity, kindness, and love. All things that my 17-year-old son has seen me not do. Driving down Ward's Road. The Pharisees, if they would have it, would have been, could have been securely in the fold. The lost sheep are those that are outside. In this context, sinners. Catch basket of deplorables. These are the lost sheep of the house of Israel that Jesus came to find. And you find these people in places your mother might not want you to go. Second story about a woman who has 10 coins. She loses one. We don't have to overthink this either. If you have money, you have 100 bucks and you lose 10, that's 10%. Now, it pains me. I don't know about you, but when I was a child, if I lost a nickel, it pained me. I hate losing money. I've done it, you know, misplace your wallet, think you had a $20 bill in your wallet, it disappears, you don't know where it goes. This woman behaves like John Heaton would. She loses 10% of the value of her coins. She gets a lamp, sweeps the house, looks between the sofa pillows. You ever done that? I've done it. Take out all the sofa pillows, throw them on the floor, tip the sofa upside down, find the money. And when you find it, you know, there's that little jump in your heart. It's like, ah. You know that feeling. There's just one application here. It's very simple. It's this, that Jesus tells these stories to justify the grumbling Pharisees, that his mission of searching for lost things is justified, it's right, and it's good. But more than this, Jesus is fulfilling so many of the Old Testament expectations that we already know. When we think of Moses leading his people out of Egypt, where do they end up? Lost, homeless, in the wilderness. God draws near to them in a special tabernacle built in their midst. When the Jews are driven into exile, God draws near to them to sustain them. We see the same thing when Hagar is driven into the wilderness and God comes to her, comforts her. We see Elijah running from Jezebel, goes out into the wilderness, lost as last year's Easter egg. God comes to him in a still, small voice. God draws near, seeks us out, provides comfort and provision, and Jesus fulfills all of this. The problem is that most of us don't listen. We don't really wish to follow. We won't acknowledge our need for him because we're too proud to admit that we have a need for a Savior. Oh, I don't mean any of you people. You're not sinners. No, left to your own devices, you wander off like a lost sheep. Left to your own devices, you'd be like that coin that just rolls away under the table or under the sofa and gets caught under the carpet so that nobody knows where it is. And by the way, this ain't Lord of the Rings. The ring wants to be found. Money doesn't. These Old Testament lessons remind us that when God's people think too highly of themselves and rely too little on Him, He will take away His blessing and put them in a desperate physical state as a way to underscore their spiritual state. And this leads us to our epistle lesson this morning, which was from 1 St. Peter. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility towards one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time He may exalt you. There's nothing so simple, or as Father Davidson said last week, oh so difficult in our faith than to carry out this exhortation. But it is the precondition. It is the precondition for being found. It's an attitude of virtue that we are to cultivate. And in cultivating humility toward one another, Peter goes on to say to be sober-minded and to be watchful, because your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion. Now, I looked it up. I didn't know this until this week. But did you know that tomorrow, June 29th, is the 80th anniversary of a long-forgotten act of resistance? That's right. On June 29th, 1940, was the birthday of Prince Bernard, son of Queen Wilhelmina of the Dutch Netherlands. The Netherlands were occupied by the Nazis in June of 1940. The royal family fled the month before to London to be safe. The prince was well known for wearing white carnations for national holidays and special occasions, including his birthday. And on June 29, 1940, people went out and placed vases filled with carnations in the windows of nearly every house and store. That day, crowds of people went to the square where there was a statue of Queen Wilhelmina, Queen Wilhelmina's mother, that is, the prince's grandmother, and they dropped carnations in an act of defiance against the Nazis. And by the end of the day, the entire monument was covered in white carnations. In response to this patriotic act, the Germans arrested two of the demonstration's organizers, and even a Dutch general, Winkelmann, who had nothing to do with it. And what followed after that day was a long struggle of resistance by teachers and artists, professors, doctors. What did the resistance look like? Well, it didn't look like taking out weapons and shooting Nazi soldiers in the street. And by the way, your resistance to the devil doesn't look like David snatching a lion by the beard and beating it with a heavy club. Resistance looks different than that. Depends upon your occupation. But everyone resisted the Nazis in subtle ways. They did it in everyday actions. Nationalist pride was no longer signaled with a handshake, but with the V. The simple greeting in Dutch, forgive my Dutch, I don't know anything Dutch, but their word for greeting is hallo, which is like our hello, but it became an acrostic for, and I'm just going to butcher this, Han Arle Langeraders Al. Hallo translates, hang all traitors. Citizens could be seen wearing coins as jewelry because it bore a portrait of the queen. Stamps were used to fuel Dutch national pride. They were always located on the left corner of envelopes because the Dutch believed that the right corner belonged only to stamps with the image of the queen. The Dutch resistance did take some violent turns, of course, but for the everyday Dutchman, resistance consisted of small actions of protest and being subtle, yet visible and annoying to the Nazis. Peter tells us that the devil walks around as a roaring lion and we are to clothe ourselves with humility, which is a strange way to meet the enemy. That's startling language. Nothing subtle about a lion roaring and stalking its prey. How do we resist him? We resist by cultivating the everyday graces of our faith. A soldier may see combat occasionally, but most of his time in service is spent in training, preparing, maintaining equipment, going on maneuvers. Most of his life is boring until the war begins. Good athletes don't win games on the court, they win them in the off-season. Everyone knows that. And likewise, most of your daily time is not spent clubbing the devil in some sort of spiritual combat. Most of your daily time should be spent firming yourself in faith. Here's five or six things that you should consider. And I know that you think it's going to go on for 60 more minutes. No, this won't take long. Number one, attend to prayer. Yes. But rather, cultivate a posture of prayer throughout the day. Just think about that. Live in conscious dependence on the grace of God. And when you do that, it reduces your estimation of yourself. That's a way of clothing yourself with humility. Consciously practice humility in all things. This is my second thing. Practice humility in small things. How could you do that? Deference to others. Check your haughty thoughts. This reduces your estimation of yourself. Here's number three, avoid wrath and clamor. Avoid the outrage that Fox News or CNN or whatever it is that you like to watch provokes in you. The whole country wants you to be outraged all the time. That's the whole point of the news. Not really to tell you the truth. And of course, social media is only designed to do this. The devil would be pleased, very pleased, if you lived an anxious life fomented by the 24-hour news cycle. Peter says, don't be anxious at all. He cares for you. How do you cultivate that? Well, just be careful what you're watching and how you react to it. Avoid anger. You don't have to win every argument on Facebook against your adversary. And when you do that, guess what? It reduces your estimation of yourself. Fourthly, and this one is odd, I would suggest that you cultivate generosity. Tangible acts of kindness that are aimed at meeting the need of another person or bestowing an unexpected favor on someone else makes you other-oriented. And guess what? This reduces your sense of your own importance. This is a way of clothing yourself with humility. And if you really want to go to grad school on generosity, try this. You want to take it to the highest level? Make your acts of generosity anonymous. This completely takes you out of the picture and eliminates the perverse desire for self-recognition and the pride that follows it. Clothe yourself with humility. Reduce your sense and estimation of yourself. And finally, be sober-minded and watchful. I don't think the devil is a roaring lion, comes around to the sheepfolds that are attended by prayer, full of people who are constantly deferring to others, avoiding wrath and clamor, cultivating generosity, and being sober-minded and watchful. He moves on to more unsuspecting folk, the outraged, the selfish, the prideful. Be aware of what is going on in your family. Be watchful. Be aware of what is going on in your business or your church. Look out for one another, the people sitting next to you in this room. Be watchful just means be involved in their lives and know what's happening to them. You are a body, after all. You don't live separate, disconnected lives from this place. This shouldn't be the only place that you connect or see the people that are sitting around you. Think about one another. Care for one another. These are the everyday acts of resistance which cause the devil to flee from us. Brothers and sisters, we were lost. We have been found, and we have been called to walk in humility as children of God. Amen.